Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. If you'd like to call in and be a guest and give us your perspectives, your ideas on current events in state-sponsored, organized psychiatric industries, you can call 267-521-0167. This is another open line show, so feel free to give a call and let us know what you'd like to talk about. We do have some upcoming events that I wanted to just mention, and I'll talk about again throughout the show, but the Alliance's, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Days vigil will be held on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health July 13th, beginning at 6 p.m., running through July 16th at 6 p.m. We sit vigil for 72 hours because that is how long in most places in the world the police can pick you up and bring you to a psychiatric institution where they can detain, assess, and treat you for 72 hours to determine whether or not you need to be institutionalized. And so that will be July 13th to the 16th. It's a wonderful, amazing event, and I will be broadcasting live from there. Then on July 24th through the July 27th will be Mind Freedom International's 2014 Creative Revolution Conference, and will include keynote speakers such as Robert Whitaker, who has written An Anatomy of an Epidemic most recently, and Mad in America, and supports the Mad in America website that is a wealth of information. And Mary Ellen Copeland will also be joining in and being a keynote. There'll also be workshops around Hearing Voices Network, peer-run respites, open dialogue, and coming off of psych drugs safely. And so I would like to just remind you that you can get information there at www.mindfreedom.org, and that will be a great event. And I will also be broadcasting live from there. It will be held at Wisdom House in Connecticut, July 24th to July 27th. We do have a couple of callers on the line. If you'd like to speak, be sure to press the 1 on your phone so I know to let you in. But line 202, your line is open.
Hi, this is Yvonne. I just wanted to listen. I heard you give information about the Mind Freedom Conference, and I assume that there's still space available.
There is still registration available, and they also have day commuter passes for people who may not want to stay the entire time and just come for sections of it. Going through mindfreedom.org, you can find out information there. It's on their first front page. It's the Creative Revolution Conference. And
what's the major city airport that's near there?
Oh, that's a good question, and I don't know off the top of my head, but it is in Connecticut, and it is, if I remember, definitely a retreat type of center. So it's a bit of a way from things, but I'm sure that the information must be up on Mind Freedom somewhere, and I will try to get that for everybody. So that's just things that are coming up, and throughout the show we'll find that information and get it up for everybody. I do have something really urgent that I want to call people's attention to, and that is in New York State there is a new bill that is out sponsored by Young and with multiple co-sponsors. That is in the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Committee, and the law section is mental hygiene law. And it's a bill that will enhances the assisted outpatient treatment program and eliminates the expiration and repeal of Kendra's law. and the bill number is S2225D-2013. And this is of urgent importance for everybody in New York, obviously, but for everybody in the country, anybody who may be listening. We all know that New York is in Kendra's law. This is Kendra's law that we're talking about here, the involuntary outpatient commitment law. And many people, including myself, believe that this is torture. And maybe I should also include the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture, who has deemed many of the practices of psychiatry as torture or ill treatment, and violations of the Convention Against Torture. And so,
Dr. Kinney, I believe that all of these are laws in the individual states, even if it's happening in New York or Colorado or somewhere else, because what happens is when people go before the state legislature to advocate for these kind of torturous conditions, they will point to other states doing it. People in the legislature, and this is just, we see this with the press too, what they'll say is anyone else doing it? And, you know, what's the result? So even if you don't live in New York State, if New York gets something and they use it, and they start pointing to, this is what they do with Kendra's Law. They point to New York as being a model. So
right.
That's why it's very important, and even for the radio program, other people that are from other states that have things going on, it's important that we know about what's happening because they mimic it. Also, how other advocates fight these things so you don't make mistakes. You know, like, Aubrey has done some great things in Colorado, and we can learn from them. And that's why it's important.
What I want to get to, Iman, is what they're trying to do with this bill, because it's very, very frightening, and everybody needs to be aware of what's happened now. And I don't want to get into all kinds of nasty politic issues.
Okay.
But part of what has happened, because I believe, because people keep on saying, well, it's not us, it's them. Other groups of people who this law should be applied to, not people who have psychiatric histories, is that the new amendment to the Kendra's Law in New York includes people who are incarcerated. And so it's people who have been hospitalized or incarcerated that now qualify for the bill. And one of the other things, yes, that's so this is a monstrous issue that we're up against. And one of the other things that this bill does is it eliminates the ability for the bill to sunset in 2017. And so whereas many people in New York have been working under the assumption that we were going to have some period of time before this would become permanent law in New York State, this bill would take away the ability to repeal and sunset Kendra's Law. And it extends to people who are incarcerated in prisons or jails and hospitalized. And it removes, there's this clause in it that I'm a little confused by, and so I may be misrepresenting it, but I don't think that I am, of where it winds up, it used to be a 48-month period, it used to be 2 years, that you were institutionalized, and within 3 years that you had some kind of act of danger to yourself or others, according to somebody. And now it's 48 months. But it says, provided that such 48-month period shall be extended by the length of any current period of hospitalization or incarceration, and any period that ended within the last 6 months. And so it seems to me that what they've done is that they said, okay, if you had an incident of danger to yourself or others 48 months ago, but you've been locked up for 5 years, we're not going to take that 5 years into account, and we're still going to go back to the 48-month period prior to your time to make a decision as to whether or not you need involuntary outpatient commitment.
Wow.
So
you don't have to have anything going on currently. Just if it was five years ago, that's enough right there.
Well, what it's been is within the last 4 years, but now it seems that they're saying they're extending it by any length of any current period of hospitalization or incarceration. So it would be the 48 months prior to you getting incarcerated or institutionalized, and whatever time is just extended to that so that they can go back to prior to your incarceration or institutionalization. And so what if somebody's it never matters. It's on your permanent record. This is why what you were saying last night about the record keeping, this is so urgent that people pay attention to this, because everything is electronic now. And if you do something when you're 8 years old or 18 years old or 48 years old, they can hold it to you for 4 years on top of whatever it is you've been through in order to get out of that.
Well, I've seen this to happen before, wherein we had people that were committed and they were forensic patients. They got out. They were living a life. And that's what they tell me. They says, well, they're still holding something that happened, something that I did 15, 16 years ago. And then when you get into circumstances, not quite so bad, but they are holding that against the person. That means that you're going to have I call it supervision. So
I call it
torture. You're going to have a bunch of people who are, it is torture. You're going to have a whole bunch of people that you're going to be keeping, you're going to have to keep a database of some sort. But you're going to have to know at any time, and I think this goes back to the violence prevention. So if in New York if they extend that way, then what's the use of doing it? I mean, if you're going to extend it that way, somebody somewhere is going to have to, the idea would be inferred, not real, that somebody's going to have to keep track of who's on assisted outpatient treatment. That means somebody's got to report to the court. That means
there's all kinds of rules in the bill. Yeah, there's all kinds of rules in the bill of who has to do what, and if one person isn't available, you know, if it's the director of community services, the local government unit, the actual program, the case manager who's in charge of everything, and then I'm just looking at this, appointments of a representative payee or other financial management service subject to final approval of the Social Security Administration. And so you're not even going to be able to choose who your payee is anymore if you're getting any kind of assistance.
You mean, this is not just, it just extends past what kind of, the person is going to be in treatment. It's going to interfere with their financial arrangements they have.
It's the final match in slavery, where your life, liberty, and fortune is under the control of the master. Master psychiatrist, can you please help me?
What did Ann Sullivan comment on this?
I don't know. I don't know, but I know that we need to organize and pull it together, because we're definitely in trouble here. As a country, if we're now including, if this law now goes after people who are incarcerated, because everybody keeps saying, and I've been guilty of this also, everybody keeps saying it's not people with psychiatric histories, it's this other group. They didn't rule out people with psychiatric histories. They've just extended the group. They're not, and this is how it's going to happen. And it's going to go after. And I don't understand why, if institutional review boards, for example, need to be protecting prisoners' rights concerning research And technically, we're all research subjects on these post-market evaluations of these drugs. Why they wouldn't be protected in institutions from not having to comply with us. But the idea now is that when they get out, they're going to also wind up going through this process.
So I was just looking at the eligibility criteria in New York for assisted outpatient treatment. The way they've got it written on their site, it's almost like anybody who's 18 years old, who has had a diagnosis, and at some point in time they're saying that if
it's or. It's not and, it's or. And it's whether or not they think that you're going to, quote, survive safely in the community and comply with treatment. And what this bill does is it extends those, Yvonne, it extends it to anybody who's been incarcerated, and it extends the period of time from 3 years to 4 years for danger to self or others, not counting the last period of institutionalization somebody was in. So if somebody was institutionalized for a week, it would go four years and 1 week. If somebody was institutionalized for 10 years, what it seems to me is that it will go 4 years plus 10 years. And so they will still, even after you've done your time, been able to go back to the incidents that caused your time as a reason to put you in involuntary outpatient commitment.
Well, it could be like two times, is that way I was reading it. So somebody that went in the hospital for a couple of days and then maybe a year, 2 years later, they went in for a couple more days, they might be subject to that too.
Right. No, they didn't take that away, but they've added the idea that the actual time that you're in the institution extends whatever time they can go back in your life history to point to why you need to be institutionalized. Area code 609, your line is open.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, this is Jason from Jersey.
Hi, Jason.
Hi. Isn't this another name for this, preventive detention?
Preventive detention. Is that what they call it?
I don't know. Isn't that a legal term? That essentially that's what this is. They're trying to prevent us from, committing violent acts or prevent us from breaking the law by using our, the fact that we've had have this history, a record, a psychiatric record. Isn't that preventive detention? Do you know that? Do you know that term? That's against the law.
I don't know that term, but it definitely seems like something that would be against the law. I'm not a lawyer. I spent a lot of time reading Black's Law Dictionary, but I'm just looking. I just think
I've heard that used in this context before.
I'm just looking online on definitions. I'm just on Wikipedia, so take it with a grain of salt. But it says preventative detention is an imprisonment that is punitively justified for non-punitive purposes. And so in most jurisdictions, people suffering from serious mental illness may be subject to involuntary commitment under mental health legislation. This is undertaken on health grounds or in order to protect the person or others. It does not, strictly speaking, constitute a form of preventative detention because the person is detained for treatment and released once this has proved effective. And so you're never released because they have no proof that it's effective because it's all a fraud. What a joke. And that's there just on... Just on Wikipedia. Wow.
Yeah, well, I mean, the treatments are tortures, and they disable us, really. So it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, and also they claim that, and Omar claims that they're doing it relapse. And
right,
a person who's on many kinds of harsh chemicals can have a reaction that is a chemical reaction that looks like relapse. When I was hospitalized, I was compliant with my medication. I was taking it as prescribed, but I was suicidal and out of control. And this happens to many people. And I think my opinion is that a lot of these attempts will make people go underground because it will be like they will not want to discuss their psychiatric history with anyone because
they will be
subject to being, pulled in. And as we've mentioned on several shows, assisted outpatient treatment is not really treatment. It's a judiciary process.
Right.
And it can... I'm sorry, you were saying something?
No, I'm just thinking about... Yeah, I had to go to the ER last night. I had an allergic reaction, a rash. I had to go to the ER, and I was there for many hours. But, they started to do they were asking me questions, and they started to probe a little bit. And I guess they were trying to screen me, do a mental health screening. They said, do you need to see someone? Are you suicidal? Are you, because I was explaining to them that I was under stress, that it might be contributing to my reaction. I get a bad rash on my face, neck, and my body. But, they started to do a kind of a screening. And I said, look, I will never voluntarily see a psychiatrist or a mental health worker. So you can just, stop there, because she was preparing to ask me a bunch of questions.
Because you had a physical symptom of a rash on your body.
Getting a mental
health evaluation. Great.
Right. And also I mentioned I was under stress at home and that there was, other factors. So they go right into this thing. And I guess you were saying, or I've read that, that they're doing these mental health screenings everywhere, that it's just part of a medical interview, no matter what.
Yeah, the Affordable Care Act puts it all in.
And I feel, and I feel threatened by that, and I will, and that's why I just cut it off,
Mm-hmm.
I feel that, because I felt that, it is relevant to what's happening to my skin and other things, that I'm under stress. I feel that it is relevant, but I couldn't talk about it. I felt that I didn't want to talk about it because they bring up this mental health stuff, and they know they've got my record right there. They know I've had ECT. They know I have a diagnosis. So I feel threatened by that, and I pull back, and I won't say anything. And I just say flat out, I will not see a psychiatrist voluntarily or a mental health worker. And I told him because I said that, the treatments are dangerous. The treatments are not effective. And
you're speaking as somebody who's had electroshock and who has had other procedures, right? I mean, you've been through the ringer with these people, right?
Yeah. I've got the TMS thing in my chest attached to a nerve. I've taken the drugs for over 20 years, and then I had electroshock, and so that's where I'm coming from. And I've got a record. I probably have multiple diagnostic labels and stuff.
Actually, very reasonable. I mean, you were acting very reasonable considering your history.
Yeah, well, I'm very wary now. Whenever I talk to a doctor, I feel that I can't really be honest about, even if, about my, emotional state and how that affects my general health,
mm-hmm.
Because I feel threatened by the psychiatric system. And I even, the other day I was at there's this thing called ICE that they started. It's an early intervention support service, and it's to keep people out of the emergency room. And it's based on the living room model. And I've noticed they've been opening up a lot in this state, and I think they're nationwide. And it's called Twin Oaks. And it's called Early Intervention Services, or ICE. And I went in there and did an interview. And for a day and then another day. and talk to a counselor. They've got a whole staff working there. They've got a psychiatrist. They've got a nurse practitioner. But they also have they had a peer advocate there. So I thought I'd try it out. But they had cameras in the facility in the corner, and I think they were recording, private conversations and stuff. So I didn't go back because of that, And they said it. I went in thinking that just to get a little more support in the community, But I terminated that after about 2 weeks. I didn't go back. I missed an appointment. And I was just thinking, well, why are there cameras? Why am I being recorded?
Although, Jason, I will say that if there weren't cameras that were installed by the federal government at Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room where Esmond Green was murdered because of the staff, but the fear is that what they're doing is monitoring us, when what they should be doing is monitoring the staff, right?
Yeah.
I think it's a really important point that you brought up, because privacy, we've lost our privacy entirely everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you're in a place of where you're going to, with the idea that you're going to get confidential support, to have video cameras running. But that being said, if they were monitoring what the staff were doing, without that evidence, we would have never known about Esmond Green's murder.
And the early intervention is usually done between the ages of 3 and 22.
Okay.
That's between the ages of 3 and 22. That's why you have toddlers taking very strong chemicals, because they're they are really looking for early intervention. And that little meeting that we discussed that NAMI had April the 4th, for some people, it may say, well, it would seem like a good thing. You'd want to find out if your child had a disability. But the way they've expanded the DSM, it's like almost anybody would have one of those things, that they claim.
Well, anybody is
diagnosable,
right? And I think, when NAMI, that's already raked in over $500,000 in the first quarter of 2014 from pharmaceutical industries and health services companies and others. This is an affront for the pharmaceutical industry, and there are all of these parents and loved ones who are getting this information from them. And I feel so, because they're just looking for help for their loved ones. They don't know the politics behind this necessarily.
Right.
And so they get trapped in it and are told that, and then that makes it more contentious between family members, because they're being told lies, and so the people who are suffering and being subjected to this torture aren't being taken seriously or believable, because they're being told that this is a symptom of their disease, that they will say these things, and that there's no proof of, and that it's such a fraud. I did find the Mind Freedom, the Wisdom House retreat and conference center where Mind Freedom's conference is going to be, and there are multiple ways that you can get there through Metro North, Bonanza Bus Lines, Bradley International Airport, and then there's a bunch of different taxi services and charter buses that are available. So you can find out that information at wisdomhouse.org/directions.php. And I'll see if I can get it posted up online also. So if you're listening and you'd like to talk, press 1 on your phone, or you can call in at area 267-521-0167. That's area code 267-521-0167. So I think that this new bill, that's being put forward, and that's gonna wind up getting rushed through.
What is this? How is this different? This is Kendra's Law, and this is another bill. How does it modify the law as it is?
Oh, Jason, it's awful. So the first thing that it does several things, and one of the most concerning to me, well, they're all concerning, but it eliminates the ability to have the law sunset. And it's still like a pilot law of sorts. And so it was supposed to sunset in 2017 because in the New York Safe Act they extended it that far when under the Gun Act they wound up putting in extra laws about Kendra's law. But it eliminates the ability to repeal it, like from whenever it would get passed, for it no longer to be able to sunset. But then it also extends the period of time that they can go back in your life to use as a justified reason, because it seems to take the time that you are institutionalized or incarcerated. Incarceration has been added to this. So either hospitalized or incarcerated, it takes that time and extends it on top of the 48 months that they can go back.
Okay.
So any amount of time,
It widens the net, or it gives more.
So they won't let you go.
Okay.
And so your past history, and with all of the records becoming, you know, electronic medical records, and then this smart pill that can detect what your levels are inside of it, that, you know, that's been approved by the FDA and is being used.
That's real? This thing has
that's real.
That stays in your – where does the chip wind up? In your body.
It's my understanding that there's some kind of magnetic thing that's also used, and so they put some kind of patch on you on your skin, and then it like is attracted to that patch, and then they read it through that way.
Man.
It's a smart pill with chips and cameras. It's a robotic part that, in other words, your doctor or even you swallow that computer chip. It's about the size of a grain of sand, so even somebody, you might have it and you didn't know it. When it hits your reading from there,
like an invisible leash.
It transmits a signal to your computer indicating that you have successfully taken your medication. So it will then be sending information about, you know, how much you took, when you took it, and all of that. It's you can just Google smart pills, because it's already you can Google smart pills, okay? And
we've talked on the show multiple times, the issues of veterans, for example, are very important to me. Because of what's happening to them when they're coming back and the way that they're just being psychiatrized. And DARPA announced an initiative of where the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, where they're going to develop a, quote, tiny implanted chip in the skull to treat psychiatric disorders such as anxiety, PTSD, and major depression. And in an article that I was reading, that they'll be able to, in live time, monitor neurons firing and be able to interfere with them. And so they're testing this on veterans. That's who the subject test for this implanted devices are. And so it's very concerning that they're planning on going after, and it really puts question.
The Information Center in Washington, they're actually very worried about that. They have used it, and they've been using it since, I know, at least this, the early part of the 2000s on Alzheimer's patients.
People with epilepsy and Parkinson's also.
It's the Drug Administration. So this is, you know, this is here. This is not sci-fi or something for the future.
Right.
It's being used now. It's already here.
Future,
so it's not supposed.
The future is now. And it is now, and it's scary. And this involuntary outpatient commitment law in New York that all of the states are modeling their laws after, I didn't even know how much time we have to fight it. It says that it's being printed, it's amended and recommitted to mental health and developmental disabilities, and that it's got a print number, and that print number is 2225D. People really need to speak out and get involved. I've set up a couple of Facebook pages on Facebook. Stop Kendra's Law Expansion, Sunset Involuntary Outpatient Torture Now. And I know some people have issue with using the language of torture, but if nobody is saying it, nobody is saying it, and it's going to get passed through.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And we need to say it. I think that's.
Yeah. You're certainly. When you say torture, it gets people's attention. I object to people even calling it treatment because it's not treatment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I try
to avoid that language too. I try to avoid using any kind of psychiatric language or I just try to avoid it altogether.
Because I'm quite sure if it's happening to you, if it was happening to me, I would consider it to be torture because it was against my will.
Mm-hmm.
And experimentation, it's certainly experimentation, and to have any kind of evasive
mm-hmm.
thing in your life, because the judicial
mm-hmm.
process can also say what type specific interventions you can have, whether it be chemical, whether it be a patch, whether it be a depot, whether it's taking something in a shot every 2 weeks or a month, whether it's going to a particular center. I mean, they can make it so you can't work. So if you
they do make it so you can't work, and it's creating jobs for these psychiatric workers who are
mm-hmm.
blindly either they're fooled or complicit, as the Occupy
mm-hmm.
APA Lucy posters state.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're fooled in 2014, you should have your license barred, because anybody can get this information anywhere. And
mm-hmm.
we really need to get to the public and inform them about the fraud that is being perpetuated here and perpetrated, the violence
mm-hmm.
against us, the violence that is incurred by having these drugs injected or forced by pill into your bodies, that this is violence.
Well,
some people
yeah.
call it rape.
I think the treatment is always... It's always involuntary because, yeah, it's always coerced. It's always involuntary because if you agree to be, voluntary, quote, and if you decide that, you want to step out, you want out, you're treated involuntarily. There's no such thing as voluntary
right.
treatment, really.
It's a veil that it's voluntary.
Yeah,
and for
yeah.
somebody who for their entire life voluntarily wants to be involved, they'll never understand how once they no longer want
mm-hmm.
to be involved, that their voluntariness mm-hmm. was moot, because it didn't matter
mm-hmm.
whether or not they wanted it, they were getting it. And
exactly.
and this is a major issue, and it affects people who are economically struggling at much greater rates than it does people who are wealthy, and those who are working, those whose insurance runs out, for example, and gets piled over into the state system, and now loses the ability to continue working or to pursue their educational goals, and the fight that we have to do in order to be able to say that we deserve to be educated and trained in the fields that we want to work in is ludicrous. And they rob our lives from us. It is an absolute betrayal. And they get to go on and continue making, all the money they want to make and getting all of the, accolades of, you know, appearing on television and being considered a person of power and all of this other garbage.
I think it's ethical because no other, if you buy into the thing that is the illness, and I know that some people that are listening to this don't, but if you buy into this illness, mostly it takes away choice because there's no other illness wherein, unless you're in danger of dying, you know, where someone will say, because of your religious belief, we're going to go before a judge because if you don't take this transplant or this blood transfusion, that, you know, you're going to die. But, you know, these kind of interventions is not even a case where a person's choice. In other words, you know, maybe I don't want whatever is manifestations that you say is an illness, whether it's hearing voices, whether it's having extra energy or whatever. So it's my choice to say that I don't want that tap down, as you know. And I think that when they extend these things and they give other criteria that are other than, they're using it to prevent relapse, but they're really trying to use it for, they use it in the guise of public safety, and it's not even that. I mean, if you're saying that we want to do this, and I think that the New York stuff was saying that what little I can read, I haven't read the additional expansion. It seemed as though that was geared toward relapse prevention. And all the cases that I know of, wherein I know in the Kendra's Law case, the guy was begging for help, was going for hospital after hospital, and they were letting
him out.
Right,
he wouldn't have qualified. Right, Andrew Goldstein would not have qualified for this law. He was refused consistently over dozens of times, refused assistance because nobody wanted to deal with him for whatever reason. And probably my guess is because they have these outcome based management things, and so unless you are like somebody who they think is going to quote unquote be compliant and a good patient, they're not going to take you because they only get paid if they have outcomes. And so if they see you as somebody who they're not going to get outcomes out of, they don't want to deal with you. And
there's enough people that really want to. I just spoke today with one of their members who is going for, what do they call it, guardianship. And actually the person is being punished because they've demanded service. They were on an ACT team. They weren't giving them ACT. They had a reaction to medication. They checked themselves in the hospital. And they can't get service. So a lot of times what happens is people are asking for, you know, some people are asking for psychiatry. They can't get it. Then when something horrendous happens, then they're not getting it. And I don't see that these are medical,
you know,
medical decisions.
And
it wouldn't
have solved it even if they did. That's the other thing, that psychiatry doesn't have a solution to this.
Right,
so
right.
Even if they did get it, it wouldn't necessarily stop this. This is about anger. This is about hatred. These are human emotions. This is not psychiatric, some quote-unquote brain disease that people are unaware of.
I'm agreeing, but using their rationale, you cannot predict. Relapse if you buy into even like I said, given, even if they said this is the illness, relapse, even if you're taking the chemicals or the reaction to it, is a part of the normal course. So you're trying to present something that you can't present. You know, even if you buy in, if a person buys into that, I mean, even if you just set aside and someone says, well, I can't Yvonne or I can't Lauren say that this is a fraud because of what happened to me, or whatever else, the disability. Even then, it's something that they cannot do. You cannot prevent these reactions that people are having because the intervention itself causes a person, anybody that has taken any of these chemicals for any length of time, they've had where they failed to work. In the way that they say they are. So it's it's setting a person up to be perpetually monitored, is what I'm saying. And that's why we really got to be concerned about it, because they can't guarantee that because of having this, even if a person's compliant. Like I said, I was, when I went to the hospital, I was compliant. I did everything
and
they
and
said.
I think, and yeah, and so, and then there's where the fraud is, and I think that this term that Jason brought up, preventive detention, is something that we really need to be looking at and figuring out legally, how do we overturn this? The same way legally, how do we overturn the idea that being in an institution that you're, that slavery, the 14th Amendment doesn't apply to you if you're in an institution. And so we need to change the general society's opinion of this, and you know, and I say this with great respect for the people who think that if we use language like torture, that it will wind up being damaging to us because people won't take us seriously or listen to us. I think that we need to get people to be comfortable with the idea that they have been lied to, and that that this is torture, and that it's slavery, and that they're killing people.
Mm-hmm.
A marked 15 to 30 year loss of life for people on psychiatric drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing to children, and creating these pipelines right into the psychiatric system, and the expansion of diagnostic,
yeah,
all kinds of diagnostic, yeah, labels, including things like autism being.
Well, there was a time when there
weren't,
you know, when there really were no voluntary patients. I mean, I think that's a more recent, you know, maybe the last 50 years, that's a more recent phenomena. And I think it's because psychiatry is just spreading everywhere, you know, in so many ways. But, you know, I think in the past that being a voluntary patient was not something that was very common like it is today.
Right. Right, absolutely, because that's one of the things that came out of the deinstitutionalization and the Community Mental Health Services Act. And then to find out, you know, like, I'm so blown away by this thing that that JFK had Jackie Kennedy electroshocked because she was sick and tired of him having an affair, and they had a fight in the street, according to this new book that's coming out. And I'm just like, this is the same guy who developed the Community Mental Health Services Construction Act and the CMA, like 50 years later, to find out that he's having his wife electroshocked in the community. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was why. Maybe because they had to commit her and he wanted it just to be done on an outpatient basis. I mean, it turns the entire conversation around so deeply, and the women, like Don White was pointing out and others have pointed out, 70% of the women in Canada who are getting electroshocked are women, 70%.
Oh, yeah.
And in the United States, in New York, for example, we know that the person most likely to be shocked is a woman over 62 years of age. And so these women who are being subjected to it, and then everybody. Anybody, regardless of gender or any other, social constructs that they've created for us to divide ourselves amongst, for anybody to be subjected to this is, it's torture. Mm-hmm.
Well, no one says anything good about it. Even the people even the few people that say, that worked for me,
yeah,
even though they had to have continual ones, and they talk about the memory loss as very grave. So, I mean, I don't see anyone who's headed to be a poster child for pro-electroshock. You don't see Lauren, you asked someone, I think someone had, we were thinking that they had commercials on TV for ECT. I have to say, you're not going to see commercials for ECT, and I'm fighting back laughing now because I just could imagine the commercial and the disclaimer that they have to have is, don't this if you want to lose the memories of your honeymoon and the knowledge you have for your profession or whatever else, because, I mean, all the information that they have about it, if you go on, it always seems kind of rosy. But I haven't met anyone that would say this is something that if I had it to do, I'd do it again and again. You know, I think would go, if they were forced to have ECT, we'd have safe houses for people to hide out in. It would have to be. Because it is such, I don't understand why the press, I've seen this on TV and everything, where they try to convince people. They put on, they says, well, the new ECT, the pulse, you know, this is what they're doing. I remember seeing a story on CBS. But they don't have any, they never have a person other than a doctor to say, well, this worked well for me. Because
yes,
it is important.
I mean, and the other thing is for people to realize that some people do report that they, that it is, you know, helped them or whatever, made them feel, quote-unquote, better. But if you look at the diagnostic statistical manual, anywhere that they have a diagnostic code for mania or hypomania or any kind of elated kind of feeling, there's an asterisk that says to be sure that electroshock hasn't recently been delivered because it's known to cause occasionally cause a euphoric thing experience, and that blocks you out from getting diagnosed with bipolar. So for people
by the,
who are,
I just want to add real quick that euphoric feeling that lasts maybe two to four weeks after the course, after 6 or 12.
Yeah.
Electroshock, that euphoric feeling is called a head injury high. Any kind of assault to the concussion is called a head injury high, and I think that's what they're looking for, you know. And,
the
and
brain
I was,
damage
I was,
to cause to
I
cause
was
brain
warned,
damage.
I was warned
right.
by my psychiatrist said to my family, I was warned at some point that I might become manic, something like that. But I apparently for about 2 weeks, it was around Christmas when I came home, and that's how I was. I was my family, so I was all over the place. I was very active. I don't remember any of this, but I was manic or euphoric for a couple weeks.
A damaged brain high. What did you call it, Jason?
Yeah, it's called. It's commonly referred to in the TBI literature and as it's called a head injury high.
Head injury high.
Yeah.
Head injury. Wow, high.
Yeah. I've never heard of that. So does that mean that if you want to get that high again, you have to get shocked again?
Yeah, or
but
you know.
That's why they call it quote unquote maintenance, right?
Yeah, that's what the maintenance treatments are. They do these at, I think, every 2 weeks or once a month, if you feel that you're benefiting in some way, or someone else feels you're benefiting, which is usually the case.
Right,
because
the maintenance is court ordered. It's not like people are voluntarily going.
No, and Linda Andre points out in her book that the few people who do come out and report how marvelous ECT has been for them and how it's transformed their lives for the better are held up by the industry, the shock docs and the industry. They're held up like saints. I mean, they're making a lot of money, publishing their memoirs about how shock treatment saved their lives. I can mention, the names of people who've written about it and claim that they've benefited from it. But if you talk to these people and scratch a little bit below the surface, you'll see that they're, they've got all the symptoms of a head injury with amnesia and the rest of it. I don't know what everyone's so different. So depending on who you were before you had it, I think that's a big factor in what you're going to say about it afterwards. I mean, the variables are so many that the best book I think that is Linda Andre's book, Doctors of Deception, is a brilliant book, and
Linda is quite brilliant, and she did a phenomenal job in that. Yeah, what they don't want, Doctors of Deception, what they don't want you to know about shock treatment. Routledge published it, I think.
Let me ask you this. Do you know of any anyone who has any of these people that you that are poster child for electroshock, that are heads of Fortune 500 companies, that they themselves do brain surgery, or they're a scientist, or they're a courtroom attorney. I mean, what are these people doing that they hold up as that? I mean, do they just eat, sleep, and get shocked, and do they have a life?
Yeah.
So,
well,
you know, is that if you say that, you know, every time you get this shock, you get this euphoric high, that sounds like, I mean, like a junkie who's taking heroin or they get a high too. They say it's the most wonderful thing in the world. But when you ask them about their life, I mean, do they have a job? Do they have relationships with other people? I mean, when you scratch there, then it's like, you know, what difference does it make if you feel euphoric if you can't remember your graduation of your son or your daughter? If you can't remember the fact that you married to somebody, I mean, what difference does it make if you have all those maintenances? I mean, I'm quite sure that you could go and get some street drugs and get that kind of high too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that this is, I think it's, again, this confusion that people think that because it's a legal pharmaceutical or a device that's being administered by a doctor, that it somehow is different than a street drug or illicit drugs. But that this is torture, and that where they may, and I love that part of Linda's book of where she talks about these people that are held up, and where there may be these kinds of people here and there sporadically, the overwhelming majority of people, almost every person I've ever met, actually, who's discussed their experience with electroshock with me, has called it torture, a crime against humanity, that it has stolen their lives, that it has caused them great physical and emotional damage, that it has taken their memory away from them, and that these are crimes against humanity that need to be stopped. Like, and because the only people who get to the table these days are people who are either going to support some watered-down version of the message and call it advocacy, or who are outright going to support what it is they want to do, and the money that's behind all of this and the industry is just ludicrous. The only people who voted to keep this thing, to put this thing to a Class 2 device, the electroshock machine at the FDA meeting, were either the psychiatrists who were using it or the maker of the device. Everybody else said, no, keep this a Class 3. Keep this Class 3. This is experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the financial incentives to maintain this field of psychiatry are huge. And then the courts are
people beating down the door to FDA. You mean there aren't people beating down the door to say, please give me some shock? That should tell people something right there.
Well, that's a good point. And I'd like to give out the number if you'd like to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167. Do you have something you'd like to talk about concerning the involuntary outpatient commitment laws or any other part of psychiatry or your own experiences? Area code 267-521-0167. And I know there are several people who are also listening online. If you'd like to talk at any point, just be sure to press the 1 on your phone so that I know to let you into the conversation. But this bill, this S2225D 2013, enhancing the assisted outpatient treatment program and eliminates the expiration and repeal of Kendra's law, is dangerous. And it's got co-sponsors, Abado, Avila, Ball, Boniak, Boyle, DeFrancisco, Farley, Gallivan, Golden, Griffo, Hassel Thomas, Thompson, Lanza, Larkin, Libius, Little, Marcelino, Marchione, Martins, Marias, Nozzolo, Ranthofer, Ritchie, Robach, Seward, Stavisky, Valesky, Zeldin, this is horrifying that they are going to try to push this right through all over again.
And this is why, even though they tell us that Murphy is probably going to be, that Bill is going to be dead, this is what I didn't understand about their mention of AOT. There's only 5 states in the United States that don't have it. And I just couldn't understand Tea Party people who are supposed to be such states' rights wanting to tell people in Maryland, Massachusetts, New Mexico, Tennessee, and Connecticut what to do. I mean, I would want to look at those states and see, well, what are they doing that, number one, they don't want this AOT. Number two, they must be doing something right if they don't feel like it's such a great need to have. Everyone else says, well, you got to have it because you got all these people. Don't they really sick?
Maybe they just may also not be letting people out at all. So I'm not sure what's going on in the particular systems. So
Maryland may not be doing something right.
They may just not be letting people into the community at all. So they don't feel that they need it.
What? Most places, like Maryland has a less, because Maryland is near me. They have had a period of decreasing population as far as people who are institutionalized. And in Baltimore, which is the largest city in Maryland, they have a capitation program where actually they put an extra pot of money for services. That's what I would have thought, that if people kept saying, if you believe, and I know that some people don't believe that there's an illness, but if you believe there are people, even because they were institutionalized and their lives are shattered, that they need something else other than medical, the socialization, if there was extra dollars to help people with housing, to help people reengage with their community after doing that. And that's what the capitation program does in Maryland. And I recently was a few months ago in Connecticut, and they have a program wherein some peers work to go out voluntarily to help people who want support, what they call them frequent flyers, people that go in and out the hospital. And I know I talked to Larry Drain in Tennessee, and he said that just wouldn't work in Tennessee where they are. So, you know, I just feel as though that that AOT makes healthcare professionals lazy because most of the people actually want some kind of help.
They want some kind of help for themselves. They can't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got a phone in the background. Sorry. So I mean, I think it's important, and I think also it's realizing that this bill S2225D 2013, it also maybe this was always the case, but they've rewritten it. Upon determining that one or more of such criteria are no longer met, such director shall notify the program coordinator in writing that a petition for continued assisted outpatient treatment is not warranted. Upon determining that such criteria continue to be met, he or she shall petition the court to order continued assisted outpatient treatment for a period not to exceed 1 year from the expiration date of the current order. If the court's disposition of such petition does not occur prior to the expiration, the current order shall remain in effect until such disposition. The procedures for obtaining any order pursuant to this subdivision shall be in accordance with the provisions of foregoing subdivision of this section, provided that the time restrictions included in paragraph 4 of subdivision of this section shall not be applicable. And in here, this contains, of this section shall not be applicable. Any court order requiring periodic blood tests or urine analysis for the presence of alcohol or illegal drugs shall be subject to review after 6 months by the physician who delivered the written treatment plan. And any such physician shall be authorized to terminate such blood tests or urine analysis without further action by the court. But this is implanting any drug or alcohol found in your urine, and for alcohol, which is legal, for you not to be allowed to consume alcohol without any kind of necessary cause for that. This is part of what's happening because they're mushing in together substance use and psychiatric diagnosis. And so if you just before had to deal with the substance use system, now you have to deal with the psychiatric system as well. And if before you only had to deal with the psychiatric system, you now also have to deal with the substance use system. And so it's another crimping down on people's rights and abilities to participate in activities that are legal concerning alcohol, that they're testing for alcohol in as part of AOT. And I think that that is... that is another way that we are infantilized and having to, like, request daddy's psychiatry's permission in order to partake in things that any adult is allowed to partake in. It really is so problematic. If you'd like to call in, the number is 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you're holding on the line and would like to speak, just make sure to press 1 so I know to call you in. So I don't know how is the best way to go around making these changes and getting our opinion out to the mainstream media, but I think that it is urgent at this point. The new language in this bill also says, provided that if after efforts to solicit compliance, such physician determines that the assisted outpatient's failure to comply with the assisted outpatient treatment includes a substantial failure to take medication, pass or submit to blood testing or urinalysis, or receive treatment for alcohol or substance use, such physician may presume that the assisted outpatient is in need of an examination to determine whether or not he or she has a mental illness for which hospitalization is necessary.
That's unbelievable.
People don't understand how dangerous this is.
Yeah, they got to, and the fact that now we have electronic records, so everyone will know if you've had, if you at any time have been in a state hospital, or if your current physicians are share same electronic records with a psychiatrist, then they will know about your psychiatric history. I think it's very dangerous because a lot of times people, those who voluntarily take the chemicals, it is important that people in their other healthcare providers that provide them with real treatment know the chemicals that they're taking, and people are going to be reluctant. No, already we have people reluctant to tell their primary care doctor that they take antipsychotic or something like that. They don't tell them about it, and they have a counter reaction. I've had numerous people where they haven't told their primary care doctor, and they get kidney or liver problems because something else that they're taking is conflicting. I don't see, I see not only it's torture, but it's not going to make people be honest and truthful with their physicians about what they're taking for those people who do see some benefit in some of the interventions, and it's going to really just drive people underground, and we're going to have people to die because they are dying because we're dying earlier, but there are going to be people who are not going to inform, just like the gentleman said when he went to the emergency room. He cut the talk off about that, and I'm quite sure now he's not taking any kinds of interventions the way he feels about psychiatry. But this is going to be a very dangerous situation if other states decide to emulate it. And
It is, and I want to just underscore something that you're talking about here and bring it to the Murphy bill, which they're now planning on passing the quote-unquote uncontroversial parts piecemeal. But the uncontroversial parts that they're saying are uncontroversial include coordination of care. And Kendra's law, one of the things that it consistently discusses is how this is an effort to increase coordination of care. And involuntary outpatient commitment programs under Murphy's law, when they talk about coordination of care, this is what they're talking about. And the lack of compliance as being a determination of quote-unquote illness instead of a determination of health, and that people don't need this garbage.
Right. Self-determination.
Self-determination. There you go. It's all written in the bill, and things like whatever becomes of the Murphy and Barber bills are going to wind up increasing this, because they all agree that involuntary outpatient commitment is fine and that it's not torture and that it's helping people. And I think that this is very dangerous, and we need to be speaking out about it.
Let me ask you some more, because I haven't read that part, and I'm going to have to do some research on that. That coordination of care, because in some form that already exists, how is that different than the health homes?
Well, we've been saying in New York that the health homes were going to be the most dangerous thing, because they actually are going to wind up replacing the involuntary outpatient commitment or mimicking it, perhaps without a court order attached to it. But this is exactly what's happening. And so it's the making sure that people who are in this quote-unquote group are in services and that they can bid for us and buy and sell us at the lowest price most amount of services for the least price. And you know that those services are going to wind up being drugs, and that they name drugs, that non-compliance with the drugs is enough to be brought in. But so is refusing to have a urinalysis. So, you know, if that's enough to get you institutionalized these days, like, we're in real trouble. Like, not wanting to give your bodily fluids is grounds for being put into a psychiatric hospital. Like, we're in trouble, folks. We're in trouble. And unfortunately, I really fear that it's going to be too late. That it's going to be too late.
Does the coordination of care, you know, because the federal government, I don't know if it's very honest, is it only for Medicaid and Medicare, or they're asking for this to be some system-wide takeover of the medical profession? Because, you know, I know that many of Murphy's colleagues consider ACA as to be a takeover. But how widespread is this coordination of care going to be?
Oh, I don't know, but under the Affordable Care Act, since this is all required and all of those records are coordinated and electronic, and that you don't have the right to write in your records, like, you're not writing up what happened at your doctor's visit. Your doctor is. Like, in general, I'm just talking about general practitioner. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but anybody receiving mental health services, this isn't limited to Medicaid or Medicare for the mandated mental health screenings. That's everybody under Affordable Care Act. That's why so many of the doctors are speaking out against it, because they feel like their practices are being controlled by the government.
And I'm surprised that the supposedly, I think that, what's his name, Paul, of the Libertarian, that's in Congress, Ron Paul.
Okay.
Is speaking out a little bit about this as well. So he sees this, the AOT and the database. In fact, I posted something yesterday on my Facebook page about this, but he's been speaking out about it as well.
I mean, I hate to say it, but I feel like libertarians are the only group of people that we're going to really get supportive, and since they're in the small minority and within the small minority of themselves, it really makes it difficult. And because of so many of their social positions, it makes it almost impossible to work with them. There really is a draw that we're at, and we are at that final line. If you live in New York or you don't live in New York, call these people, call the sponsor, Young, and I will be giving her information out shortly, and tell her to pull back this bill, that this is not going to solve these problems, and it's going to be monstrous. Taxpayer expenditures are going to be attached to this. There's no two ways around it.
Well, at least I understand is that they're not creating any additional funds to handle the adjudication of people into AOT. So what the hell the difference is going to be? You know, if you're going to extend the time, you said, beyond when you've been held, whether in an institution or the look-back period is going to be extended forward, if they're not going to give any additional funds, how is this going to work?
It's really very troublesome. And this expansion to the entire population of people who have been incarcerated also makes this very, very, very dangerous to me, because it immediately puts a cast around all kinds of people who it expands it wildly. And
well, you know, we're going to have a releasing of a lot of people because of the clemency program that the Justice Department, Eric Holder, has taken invitation. If people online don't know this, if they know someone who is in prison at this time, and usually these would be nonviolent crimes around drug use, wherein there has been some disparity, for example, in sentencing around what a person gets who has powdered cocaine versus someone having crack, where the sentencing has not always been equal. And I know that they had recently released some figures, and they've already had thousands of people who have applied. And I'm just thinking that this might be an attempt by New York to capture those people as well. I mean, you know, if you, you know.
Right, if you're letting them all out, you want to be able to follow them. Because it's just pretty horrendous. So Catherine Young, New York State Senator Catherine Young, it says RCIP, so I guess she's Republican Conservative Independent Party. I don't know what those things mean. But mm-hmm. her information is she's in Olean, New York, and the phone number is area code 716-372-4901 to call to tell her and develop a relationship with her aides to try
you
to
got
explain.
Home
I'm sorry?
You got a home phone number too?
No, this is just her district office. And
is it Young?
It's Catherine Young in Olean, New York. And her district office phone number is area code 716-372-4901. Senator Young is the sponsor of S2225D 2013, the bill that will expand Kendra's law and eliminate the possibility for its sunset. Her Albany office number is area code 518-455-3563. And her last name is spelled Young, Y-O-U-N-G. And, you know, she's got quite a bit of legislation. She's won, it looks like it says, over 200 awards. And I think that there's a real need to educate her about why enhancing involuntary outpatient commitment in New York is a bad idea for New Yorkers and for the whole country, and that they shouldn't be eliminating the expiration of and repeal of Kendra's law. They should just be repealing Kendra's law and allowing it to sunset now.
Yeah, I really believe they're doing this for prison, because a lot of people don't know this, but in most places, you can get sentenced for drug trafficking and not really do it. And I'll give you an example. Let's say that I come to New York City, and and this happened to a real life person who's serving something like a horrendous like 30 some year term. And I say to you, Lauren, do you know where I can get some weed? And you say, and this is what this person did. She said, oh, no, I don't really know where, but after I press you, you say, well, maybe I'll just ask some of my friends about it. Well, just by you saying that you'd be willing to hook me up, or even just say, well, you can call, you know, so-and-so, they might know something to do it, but I don't do that. You are actually seen as trafficking in drugs. So you have people that don't even have used a drug. I'm not saying that there's a whole lot of people like that, but you have people like that who have been sentenced for long periods of time for these nonviolent, there's this instance I know of, this one person got hung up because somebody someone that called them were being, they were being taped by the district attorney's office or whatever else. And so this woman got hung up in this thing. And this can happen because they want you to roll over on the other person. So a person could be in prison, have a prison term, and for somebody else, says, well, why is this person? Why are they serving 25 to 30 years? But it's because of the way the law is, and that person would be subject to having, being involved in treatment, or not treatment, but torture.
It really is, and one of the things that it really bothers me about the way that this bill is written, and maybe it's always been written like this and I've just never quite seen it so clearly before, is that they keep on talking about the person who is subject to this law as the assisted outpatient. That is the name of whenever they talk about this person, they refer to them as the assisted outpatient. And so it's really cutting as to how this goes, and clearly our the criminal justice industry complex has multiple problems in it, and what is considered legal or illegal in 2014 is definitely something that probably should be revisited, and in many states is being revisited. But this goes again to this idea of the federal government usurping states' rights in being able to make its own laws and practices as to how to do that. And part of what's wanted in the Murphy bill is a clear national bill to be able to track people. One of the things that's happened with Kendra's law over the years is that it now coordinates county to county. So whereas before, if you moved out of the county that you were under involuntary outpatient commitment on, you were clear if you were in another county. But now it coordinates it, and I'm sure that what they want to be doing, and since the bill that Thompson put forth the other night was passed overnight, increasing funding for the NCIS database to include mental health records, that they want to be keeping track of us, and so even leaving the state will not be sufficient to escape the psychiatric regime. And this I see as a really big problem, that people are not going to be able to get around.
You're going to have a federal registry, just like they have. They can't keep track of the terrorists coming into the country, but they're going to be able to keep track of people, whether they take an antidepressant or whatever else.
Right, and that's the other thing to realize. Even if you're getting, or somebody you know is getting these psychiatric drugs from your general practitioner, you're still qualifying. You're still on psychiatric drugs. You may not be experiencing the dehumanization of a quote-unquote mental patient who's been institutionalized in a state facility, but as far as they're concerned, a psychiatric drug, no matter how you're getting it, is still a psychiatric drug. So if you're on Klonopin or Xanax or Valium or Zoloft or Prozac or Chantix or any of these, what's the one for diabetes, Lucera or whatever it's called, any of these drugs qualify you for having your rights taken away and for you being subject to these laws. I mean, and to remember that this is just the involuntary outpatient commitment law. Under law, if they think that there's something wrong with you, they can pick you up, hold you for 72 hours, and decide whether or not to institutionalize you without having any history of anything. And so...
And not only that, the release, there was just, I had posted yesterday, there was an incident in Ontario, Canada, where somehow they released the... They have a database of people who had, had attempted suicide or had called for help around suicide. And there's going to be a big legal action that they're looking into because someone released all those people's names. Now, you're not old enough to remember, but I am, when Eagleton was going to be on the McGovern campaign. As a vice presidential campaign, and they let it be known that he had ED.
Mm-hmm.
I can see very well now with, since we are in such a chemical society, someone running for Senate, either state Senate or county sheriff or whatever, and they may have taken some psychotropic drugs in their lifetime. And, you know, we know that a lot of these, some of these like the Klonopins and the other type of things, the general practitioners sometimes, even antidepressants, they liberally write the prescription for them. And so if they release that information, because it's part of a federal register, you know, it's not like coming from your doctor or something. You won't have any recourse to sue if your career is messed up, you know, because... They're not going to say, well, we're not going to not let you run for office or let you be a teacher or whatever else, but they'll look at something else. So this is, like you said, Dr. Tenney, very dangerous because all their privacies will be compromised.
We are, as a society, in such a struggle here. And we are further jeopardizing ourselves and coming closer to losing our humanity as more and more of these types of laws get passed and promoted and tightened. Part of what they call it in the Kendra's Law bill that's up now, S2225D, is streamlining the process. They're just streamlining it and making it a little tighter. And it's a lot tighter. I mean, I really want people to think about what does this mean that now anybody who's been incarcerated, psychiatric history or not, just incarcerated, that they can go back 48 months prior to your incarceration or your hospitalization and determine whether or not you need to be under this for something that you did 48 months prior to being institutionalized.
Well, you know, all this comes out of Homeland Security. Originally, I think some of this stuff might have been a good idea because they thought that, for example, if you presented yourself to your doctor's office, that they would be able to see patterns like, you know, of an epidemic, just like there was, I can't remember the name of it, but somebody from Saudi Arabia came to this country and they had some illness and it spread to some people. The idea was that they'd be able to pick up on, you know, even measles or flu epidemics or whatever because they'd have this information. But this has gone beyond, I guess, any time you collect data like this, there's always other people who are saying, well, we could use it for this or that. And this is going to be, make it so that people that ordinarily, some people that were in the, that would use private psychiatrists would escape this because they may not, you know, come under the flag. You know, someone who goes to see a private psychiatrist, if they do some kind of background check, they may not come up that they are have a psychiatric history right now. But with this, all they got to do is to pull up the prescription information.
Wow.
And
right.
And so you don't have to say, well, it says, well, most of these drugs aren't indicated for anything else other than psychiatric uses. I don't know if risperidone or Haldol or Abilify or some of the mood stabilizers they have. I don't know if any of them, I mean, besides seizures, if they have any kind of other
use. Oh, yeah,
use.
Maybe just quitting smoking. Or I can't think of any either.
Yeah, so, you know, there's
I don't think they do, and I just got a message from Sue who asked whether or not the Mind Freedom Shield or something like an advanced directive or a healthcare proxy would eliminate that. And Section 7D under, I don't even know how far this goes back, but it under 7D it says healthcare proxy. Nothing in this section shall preclude a person with a healthcare proxy from being subject to a petition pursuant to this chapter and consistent with the Article 29C of the Public Health Law. So they've written into the law that even if you have a healthcare proxy, even if you have an advanced directive, that those things do not preclude you from being subject to this. So if you have written down in a healthcare proxy and had two physicians sign it saying that you don't want involuntary outpatient commitment, that doesn't matter to this law. Would the Mind Freedom Shield help? It could help in terms of bringing attention to your situation and having a message that you want broadcast to people in power over you, broadcast by Mind Freedom members.
Mm-hmm.
Even a healthcare proxy does not preclude you.
Do not walk the Mind Freedom website become a member. And they do have a low income one, if that's people's case. But that really disturbs me that the healthcare directive will be overturned. See, this is where other people who really maybe object to the use of the word torture should really pay attention, because, you know, I've known people who are they're in agreement that they may be in some treatment, but maybe a specific treatment that they prefer not to have. They might be in agreement that they might want some chemical, but maybe a specific chemical they may not have. There might be a reaction they had, you know, maybe in a couple of cases I know where people had erections that lasted for long periods of time, or either they had sexual dysfunction, or they gained like 50 or 100 pounds, or they had heart palpitations. They just don't want that particular drug. So, I mean, to void your healthcare proxy, that's...
It does say further down, if the subject of the petition has executed a healthcare proxy, the appointed physician shall consider any directions included in such proxy in developing the written treatment plan. But it does not... But a proxy does not... So if you have a proxy, use it. If you haven't had... If you don't have a proxy, get one, because they have to take into consideration anything that is done in there in the plan. But it doesn't preclude you from having it. So if your healthcare proxy says no involuntary outpatient commitment, the law doesn't care about that. But if there are specifics in there that it says, then it says that the physician has to take that into account. So be as specific as you can in developing your proxy, in naming every single type of drug that you would not want to take, every single place you would not want to go, every single thing that you would not want happen to you. And those kinds of things, because then perhaps there's a case if they wind up violating your proxy. But a proxy alone does not protect you from being subject to this.
Well, the ACLU probably doesn't know about this yet. That's why it's good we have this radio program, and I hope that other people might call in if they look tonight and see if their states, what is the assisted outpatient procedures in your state? And people should look at them because as these little things change around the country, like I said, that people mimic it. They'll say, well, New York is doing this, and this is what they did. This is what the big empire state is doing. Mm. You want to make sure that, you know, that you're not going to be, your life and liberty is not going to be taken away. Because even if someone buys onto the fact that they believe that psychiatry is beneficial to them, they may not sign on for ECT. They may not sign on for drugs that might make them impotent or make them have loss of kidney function. You know, you would think that, you know, you would have your own shared decision. Just put shared decision-making all out the window.
Well, and I still don't understand why I have to share my decision with anyone. So I think that's been another place where why isn't it just my decision? Why am I not just being informed of what my options are? And then I make a choice as to which course I'd like to take, the same as if I was diagnosed with cancer or any other legitimate medical problem that can be tested with a blood test or your analysis or, you know, whatever else.
I hear you, doctor, but what happens is when some people hear us talk, they don't think it has any relation to them. And the fact is that even if you have bought onto the fact that psychiatry or chemicals or even therapy might be useful to you, this is even dangerous to you because you won't your decisions will not be taken into account. So because a lot of people just say, oh, now those are the anti-psychiatry people, those are the people that, you know, they weren't really sick anyway, you know, they're just, you know, okay. They have to understand that this is a threat to everybody. So even if you bought the Kool-Aid or a true believer, your decisions will be out the window. What you just pointed out to is that, you know, a lot of times, like, I'm quite sure the family in Connecticut that had their daughter taken away, a lot of people just don't think these things could happen to them. They haven't thought far enough down the line. As I think Congressman Barber said that, you know, there's some of these rights type things, there's a slippery slope. And once you start sliding down, more and more things are added on, you know. And this is what you're seeing with Kendra's Law. And this might be happening in other places, just that people aren't, you know, speaking up about it.
And I think that we need to continue to speak up about it and speak out. And I know many people who have been calling in and who are listening are actually subject to these laws. And when you hear the experiences that people discuss of the fear of having to deal with these people and the continued frustration of never knowing when it's going to be over, you know, people used to say that, you know, at least in prison, when your time was done. But under this new expansion of Kendra's Law, that is no longer true. They can loop you right into mandated psychiatric services coming out of prison now, and I think that's in part because many advocates, and I'm guilty of this myself, have consistently said, but we're not violent, we don't have this. And so now they've just widened the net of who it is that they can catch on this. And it's going to be very, very, very dangerous for everybody.
You say I won't comply, and you know, the threat was, I know here, is if, you know, you were, and we call it FB-12, if you were involuntarily committed, you know, as inpatient, but if you had assisted outpatient treatment and you didn't comply, you didn't go to your day program, or they tested you and they didn't feel that you were taking your medication, then they could snatch you back and take you back to the state hospital. Well, somebody could say, well, you know, I don't want to do this. You know, just take me back to the state hospital. There they have a procedure where you can, it's complicated, but you can reject your medication. I'll just go there and I'll be there for whatever length of time and they'll let me go. But this is saying that you can't do that. We're going to get you. We're going to make sure that you take treatment whether you want it or not.
And even like Jason, like you were saying earlier when you first called in, the idea of you're going to an ER because you have something clearly physically going on, and your physical issues aren't even addressed because they're too busy doing mental health evaluations. And so for people to understand what that's really like for somebody to experience and the real genuine and warranted fear that people have of interacting with doctors. I don't know if you could just talk about that a little bit because I think it's really important for people to hear.
Well, about the fear? About opening up?
About what it's like going back in there.
Well, I just,
you want them to address your physical needs and not take you to the psych ward, right?
I just feel threatened when I see the doctor. I can't even reveal information about myself that might be relevant without them suspecting that, you know, I'm going to need, treatment with drugs or being locked up.
And you've had both experiences, right?
Say that again?
And you've had both. This is a reasonable fear.
It
really is. And I wanted to say, area code 845, your line is open. If any time you want to jump in.
Hi, Lauren. It's Anthony from
Rockland.
Hey,
Anthony.
County.
Hi.
How you doing? Good. Hi, Jason. Hi, Yvonne. How's everybody doing tonight?
Hi, Anthony.
Good. I just wanted to first start off by saying thank you, Lauren, to everything that you've been doing the last couple of weeks, and I just wish I had all this information and all this knowledge before years ago, because I tried to do this all by myself, trying to come off medication, and it never worked, and I ran into a lot of problems. That's why I've been having problems lately, you know, with AOT and everything.
Right. And I thank you. This is actually the beginning of, I guess, this is 3 full weeks that this has been going on now, and it's been really eye-opening for me and a great experience to be able to connect with so many other survivors and people who are out there fighting for their own rights and the rights of others, and it's been just really amazing. And I think that it's giving us other concrete things that we can point to as to why these laws are flawed and why we need to stop them from being able to get passed. And we were just talking about the fear that is created in people when they have to deal with just regular medical professionals for fear that they're just going to be pushed off to psychiatry and then institutionalized again and had all kinds of things happen to them. And so
I'd like to use their words sometime. I don't like to use the medical jargon, but it interferes with the relationship between your healthcare professional and you.
Yes.
And be honest. You know, even if, like I said, it interferes with that because, that's what it's doing. It's interfering with your, and it's there are reasons why people need to have not information about maybe your emotional state, but about any other interventions that you might be having. So, and I hope that the caller knows about the Icarus Project now, correct?
Yeah, I know about that, Chris.
For anybody who may be looking for, to remind people that these drugs are drugs just like street drugs, and there's a withdrawal process that goes through. And some years back, Will Hall and the Icarus Project and others, I think they had 56 experts, put together this guidebook for safely coming off psych drugs. And you can find that at willhall.net / coming off psych drugs, I think, or if you just Google coming off psychiatric drugs, a guidebook. It really is a great resource for people to be able to talk about these things and find some concrete information of what to do, because the withdrawal can go on for years. Sometimes people describe really having issues coming back to who they were and really getting their personalities back, and the pain and onslaught of emotions that come with the withdrawal when you're brain is then trying to adjust to a chemical that it's been programmed to have there and not there, but that there's hope and that there's tons of different support networks that people can get involved with and different ways to.
I wish you.
You wish.
I read the harm reduction guide. I just wish I had known about this and all this information years ago. In fact, not many years ago, but a couple of years ago. I've been having problems since 2008. But like I said before, I just wish I had all this information. I wish I knew about all these organizations like Mind Freedom and Mad in America, and everybody that I've met along the way. I just wish I had all this information. But what we're doing here in this radio program is we're spreading the word and we're spreading the information and we're trying to educate people. And I thank you, Lauren, for doing what you do. And I thank everybody out there that's listening, like Sue and all the other callers that have been educating us. It's really refreshing, and just to know that there are alternatives and there is a way and there is a hope. There's hope, and things like AOT shouldn't have to terrify people like us. I'm just very thankful and grateful for all this information. So thank you. Thank everybody listening, everybody that's been calling in with all their information. This is just very, very grateful. I'm really, really happy to be a part of this.
Well,
yeah.
I think more needs to raise awareness about alternatives too for people who are struggling with an emotional problem or distress, that there are safe alternatives to these drugs and involuntary interventions.
Absolutely, and places like mindfreedom.org, trauma-informed guidebook that Darby Penny and Kathy Cave and Beth Filson and Andy Blanche put together is a great resource. We're also going to be talking a little bit on Wednesday night, June 11th. We're going to have a follow-up special edition on electroshock, where we'll be focusing on informed consent and litigation strategies. And Deborah from ectjustice.com will be on with us. And she's a shock survivor who also successfully was able to settle out of court on a psychiatric malpractice suit. And she's going to be talking a little bit about litigation strategies that people could consider using. And we'll continue to explore how can somebody give informed consent if they don't know what the efficacy or safety is, because the device has never been tested. And all of the information that we know is that it causes these terrible brain damage and body dysfunction and death and destruction of memory and lives. And so I think it's important that we continue focusing on these and to understand that the drugs are just chemical lobotomies and that's all they're doing. They're just continuing to damage our brains and to not focus on healing and health, and that in these alternative programs that you can find these spaces for where people will actually talk about healing and how it is that we can come forward.
And for any true believers out there, because I believe that using the chemicals is a choice that you have, but I would recommend people and I'm coming off, speaking as a person who I'm coming down off of like one drug from taking medications morning, noon, and night, is to ask for the manufacturer's insert, because the information that you get in the little 2 inches that the pharmacist gives you is not enough for informed consent. Usually, for example, with Depakote, the manufacturer's insert is about 18 pages. So you might want to get the manufacturer's insert. Even the abbreviated one is like 4 or 5 pages. You want to get that and look at and see what they say about the medication. Even if you can't even do that, go to a physician's reference. But you don't get informed consent because a little bit of information, that little 2 to 4 inches, is not enough to really tell you anything. So,
absolutely. And I just want to, I thank you for bringing this up, Yvonne, because I just want to make sure for people who may not know my own personal views on this, because I do come down very hard on these psychiatric pharmaceuticals, but I'm a true believer in informed consent and that people should be able to do whatever drugs they want with informed consent and that choices should be available to people as to what they want to do for themselves. And so it's never am I attacking somebody who is choosing to take a psychiatric pharmaceutical. I believe that is the part of it. But with informed consent and really having informed consent, I think what Yvonne's talking about getting the manufacturer's insert is a very important step to starting to really get an idea as to what it is that you're on.
That was what woke me up, because what happened was I was one of these people that I had not had a good night's sleep, and I got the medication, and I had been taking some medications off and on since I was 7 years of age, and had stopped, shortly upon graduating from college. And then I had some things to happen, and I was taking morning, noon, and night, and I gained a lot of weight. I'm still battling to get the weight off. And I was going to be on a particular drug, and I had talked to my doctor about it. I had asked about it because I was a true believer. And I got the information. I have to say, I have a wonderful psychiatrist. He doesn't push pills. But I was taking it one time, morning, noon, and night. And when I started reading and finding out the liver and kidney damage, and then after I took this drug for 3 months and it was not doing what it promised to do, my doctor said, well, why take it? But the thing about it, the damage had been done. My metabolism got all out of whack. So people need to read these things very carefully. I mean, all of these are chemicals. All of them are toxic. All of them are. There's none that is designed. So you have to look at it, and if you need to know the dose. For example, if you look at what's recommended for dosage, sometimes you'll get the dosage different. You are a certain weight, a certain age, and then they're just guessing. This is not an exact science. I mean, I was at a conference.
It's not even a little science.
It's pseudoscience.
It really is a pseudoscience.
But I'm just saying but they do this based on the, it's guesswork is what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to be kind about it. It's guesswork because if you really, like I said, many of these drugs weren't meant to be taken for years and years. I've been this time I've been taking medications for like 15, 16 years. So you've got to be careful, and you want to know the right dose. And why is it if you're taking, and I'm not trying to be a commercial for the medication, but I'm just saying people don't have informed consent. I was at a recovery retreat, and they had a doctor to come in, and I was very angry. And the reason why I was angry, this has been recently, is because we really didn't get full information. There is not informed consent. You need to get, and especially if you're taking multi-medication. I mean, the number of people that are taking different medications and then they're taking a medication for the side effect, you need to really know what you're putting in your body.
Right. And it's typical for people to say that they're on 13 drugs. People have called in talking about being on 12 or 13 drugs. People have called in talking about having a quote-unquote medication prompter show up at their house and make sure that they take their drug every night. I want to be really clear that for people who are economically struggling, what we're talking about is much more of an importance than for people who are wealthy. People who are wealthy are generally not going to have the state coming and chasing them down unless they're not paying their taxes. Do you know what I mean? This is an economic issue, and there are people who are being targeted out, who are being prevented from reaching their dreams, told that it will be too stressful for them to go to school or to work or to have any kind of life or family.
Or delusions of grandeur, too.
That's right.
You can't do anything. They say, well, the reason why you're not able to focus, because I went through a period of not being able to read, but the reason why you're not being able to focus is because of your mental illness. They're not going to say it's because, you know, maybe this medication might make you go to sleep, but...
Right, and this quote-unquote mental illness that has no evidence of existing, and the drugs couldn't possibly be doing it. And that's why when they started giving the drugs and they were causing all of this diabetes and this rapid weight gain, the response of the state was to take out all of the soda and candy machines out of institutions. And once it was proved that Zyprexa causes diabetes, they said, well, diabetes is better than psychosis, so we're going to continue court ordering this on people. And last I checked, diabetes kills you. And psychosis isn't proven to exist, and these delusions of grandeur. Anthony, I just want to ask you, how was it today?
Oh, you mean the thing I did over at Mercy, the accepted student stuff?
The accepted students.
It was very, it was wonderful. I was very happy to be there, and it was a great experience. And I met some people, and I sort of school, and I talked to advisors and other people, and it was a really good experience. And I think I'm very excited for the fall because I'll be starting. I'm going to be going to school part time, but I'm very excited to start school in the fall, and it was a good experience today. And you know, just so other people that are out there listening, a psychiatrist told me that I was suffering from delusions of grandeur because I wanted to go back to school to finish my degree when I told him that I wanted to go back to college. Yes.
Such a fraud. I mean, these are how it's a real crime against humanity, just putting somebody down into a box and telling them that this is the best you can hope for and you can't have the life that I have. I need to dictate your life. You can't be me. I have to be me. And the audacity and the arrogance of psychiatry to suggest that people can't get the life that they want. And I just want to congratulate you and applaud you and say that I'm so proud of you standing up against them and going after what you want.
Oh, thank you, Lauren.
You're here.
Thank you, Jason.
It really, so if you're out there listening, and you're in this boat and you're trying to figure out what to do, don't take my word for it. Go out there, do your own research, go look at alternative sites, go to even the National Institute of Mental Health, of where they outright debunk the Diagnostic Statistical Manual as not having validity and not being reliable, and talk about that there is no blood test and that there is no proof that this is a biological quote-unquote brain disease that these drugs are going to fix, and go do your own research. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or have an idea for something that we should focus on, please call the Talk with Penny tip line 24 hours a day, except when we're on air, at area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708. In the next couple of days, I will have updates on several of the deaths that have been getting looked at. On June 13th, I'm scheduled to call the district attorney's office in Fort Bend, Texas, to follow up on the Michael Blair murder, which they're calling, the police there are calling a justified shooting. When the family called the hospital refused them. This sounding familiar? And told them to call 911, and when the police arrived, the family, suspicious of the police, set up a hidden camera, and miraculously the entire thing was caught on video. And when the police arrived, in under 6 minutes, Michael Blair was shot dead 11 times, and they kept on shooting after he fell to the floor. And we're going to keep attention on this and keep updating people and letting you know how you can take action. Please go to the Stop Involuntary Outpatient Commitment webpage on Facebook. Get involved with Stopping S2225D and call Senator Young's office and the other co-sponsors of this bill and tell them that this is no way to treat New Yorkers. We deserve more. I want to thank you all for listening, and even if you don't live in New York, you can still get involved because they hold New York up as a model that all of the other states are following. And so please do get involved, speak out. I'm going to ask you to keep on talking until I talk to you next time. Talk to you soon. Thanks, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.